Okay, friends and family are always welcome. So thank you all for coming. I'm Mary Flynn. This is a Poetic Principles event, which is connected to Blackbird, an online journal of literature and the arts. And tonight we're very fortunate to have Hal Crowther and Margaret Gibson introducing us to their new books. Hal Crowther is an infuriating American about H.L. Mencken. Margaret Gibson, The Broken Cup, poems that deal with Alzheimer's and her husband David McCain's illness. And one thing both of them have in common for me and for Greg Donovan, who's here, is that they both gave us work for the very first issue of Blackbird, and we remain incredibly grateful. First, we'll hear from Hal and some about H.L. Mencken. Hal is a well-known journalist and writer of essays and commentary, for which he's been a National Book Critics Circle finalist and a recipient of the Lillian Smith Award in Southern Letters. He's received an award from the Fellowship of Southern Writers, and he also has shared thoughts and some traits with Mr. Mencken, maybe, though I think. Intelligence, in any case, and passionate devotion to certain causes. He's a writer of grace and thoughtfulness, whether it's about art or about politics or about his dog. And so, Hal, it's so nice to have you here. And he's going to tell us some about Mencken.
Thank you very much, Mary. Mencken, of course, is one of the more contradictory figures in American literature, and controversial, I guess, from start to finish. The first reporter who took notice of this particular book asked me a very direct and slightly aggressive question that was, I think, designed to put me on the defensive. She said, "What is it you love so much about H.L. Mencken?" And I answered that there was nothing so much that I loved about H.L. Mencken, that in fact I had been reading him to exhaustion for a year and a half, and I'd found considerably more to dislike than to love about H.L. Mencken personally. He was one of those narcissists who never knows when to shut up, who loves the sound of his own voice, his own prose, so much that everything he ever thought or felt ended up somewhere in those 40-odd volumes of his work. And much of it would have been better left unsaid. The difference between Mencken and the garden variety narcissist is that we too, millions of us, millions of readers, including this one speaking, also love the sound of his voice, of this reckless prejudice encased in the gorgeous English prose. And at different times in our lives, usually early on, we could scarcely hear enough of it. I was introduced to Mencken by my grandfather, who was a fanatic back when he was in college and law school, and he handed me my first Mencken when I was 15 years old and said, "Read this." And you didn't say no to your grandfather. There's not a lot to love about this complicated, self-destructive, and once almost omnipotent journalist, but there's a great deal to admire and sometimes grudgingly to respect. He feared no one and nothing, never backed down from 100 controversial, often virtually indefensible positions. And if you can say the same and write as well as Mencken, you'll impress me as much as he does. I didn't write the book to celebrate Mencken, but as a way of looking back at the heyday of my profession in this country, maybe in a kind of a wistful manner. My essay that was published in Blackbird that won a Pushcart Prize last year was about obsolescence, my own obsolescence as an antique American overwhelmed by technology, but also as a journalist. And I see that there's a certain anachronism looming here with Mencken as well. I've already met a young journalist who had never heard of him. Not surprising, maybe 58 years after his death, but to me, it was like meeting a dancer who'd never heard of Nijinsky or Margot Fonteyn. When I was a young man, though I was only 11 when he died, Mencken was still casting such a long shadow that he needed no introduction. Remember that? I used to say that on the Ed Sullivan Show. And whether you loved or hated reading him, just knowing what he was saying was proof that you were literate at one time in America. Now, perhaps, he needs an introduction. And luckily, I have written one. And I'd like to share a large part of it with you if I could. Mencken, dead for nearly 60 years with a legacy of 10 million recorded words by his own reckoning, a body of work that by any reckoning must be as large as any man of letters ever produced in English, Latin, Greek, or Farsi. Somehow the man grew posthumously as more of his unpublished work became available, attracted commentary and memoir, inspired new biographers and new scholarship, new websites, as the technophobe Mencken would have been appalled to comprehend. A public life that ended in 1948, a national and international influence that ended a decade earlier, and still Mencken is almost too big to approach with any confidence. Setting yourself to write about him, you feel like an old farmer with an old mule at sunrise of a long, hot day looking out over 50 acres that ought to be plowed before sundown. Give me strength, Lord. Where do I begin? The literary territory marked HLM on our maps is a wilderness of pitfalls, switchbacks, and quicksand, crisscrossed by 1,000 trails, many of them blazed by writers who lost their way and left no coherent account of their adventures. Is it important? Is it necessary to go there? There are American writers of greater depth and dedicated journalists with exemplary careers of clear thinking and public service who have been ignored by scholars, virtually buried in potter's fields by posterity. There are recognized arbiters of literary achievement and philosophical resonance who consign Mencken to the second or third rank, a kind of poetic justice for this hanging judge of a critic whose harsh custom was to dismiss most of his contemporaries as third-rate talent or worse. The famous Algonquin Roundtable of Literary Wits and Bon Vivant, whose collective fame has endured almost as well as his own, he swept aside in a magisterial wave of disrespect as, quote, literati of the third, fourth, and fifth rate. But Mencken, who flayed academics mercilessly all his life and compared them to things invertebrate and inanimate, did not anticipate posthumous support from PhDs. To those of us who called ourselves working journalists, I recorded my first professional byline just 5 years after his death. And now we watch numbly as we're replaced by what Mencken might call a rancid miscellany of entertainers, gossips, cover models, flacks, internet narcissists, propagandists, and headline readers. Mencken's long reign on a media throne of his own creation seems as grand and legendary as the heyday of Giotto must seem to the planet's last fresco artists. Those were the days, or so we all imagine. Has any journalist since been hailed as, quote, the civilized consciousness of America? A crown of laurels bestowed on Mencken by no less a figure than Edmund Wilson. Wilson, a critic and public intellectual with a Princeton pedigree, is now respected as a more highbrow and possibly more reliable authority on the letters and politics of the era he shared with Mencken. But he never failed to honor his debt to the older man, whom he ranked as, without question, since Poe, our greatest practicing literary journalist. Wilson's outsized regard for Mencken was echoed by other heavyweight critics of the day, notably Walter Lippmann and Joseph Wood Crutch, also holders of diplomas from the Ivy League that Mencken loved to ridicule. Lippmann, reviewing Notes on Democracy in 1926, virtually deified its author as, quote, the most powerful personal influence on this entire generation of educated people. Crutch, writing Mencken's obituary for The Nation in 1956, went even further, predicting an eventual consensus that, quote, Mencken's was the best prose written in America during the 20th century. These learned gentlemen were taken very seriously by themselves, among others, and did not dispense superlatives lightly. It's a fair question whether any journalist before or since has been so popular with his peers, his competitors, if you will. Besides their Ivy pedigrees, they fell into several of the categories of Americans that Mencken routinely abused. Lippmann was a Jew, Crutch was a Southerner, and a PhD, and Wilson flirted with communism in his youth and defended Stalin as late as 1935. None of them were in line with Mencken's politics, yet in the 20s, they were among his staunchest allies. It's been suggested, of course, that they lived in terror of offending him, like nearly everyone else. The conservatives of our current century, who attempt to adopt Mencken as a soul father for his critiques of democracy and the New Deal, are stalled in confusion when they discover that so many of Mencken's friends and associates were leftists, and even Marxists, like Theodore Dreiser and Philip Goodman. In these days of mindless, hostile polarization, we forget that in their day, even fewer people were equipped to debate serious ideas. And no matter how contentiously they disagreed, they had more in common with each other than with all the others, the lumpen masses with no ideas at all. Conservative meant something quite different then, too. Certainly, Mencken was a conservative by many measures and died conspicuously to the right of the intellectual mainstream. But it's a grievous insult and injustice to imagine him watching Fox News or celebrating the wisdom of Rush Limbaugh or Ayn Rand, or to conflate him with the oxygen-starved brains that conceived the Tea Party. Sadly, the same tribe of benighted hominids he expelled from the human race in his dispatches on the Scopes monkey trial in 1925. Sorrow of sorrows, one of them who rejects evolution, embryology, and the Big Bang theory, all as lies straight from the pit of hell, was recently a candidate for a U.S. Senate seat in Georgia. Human progress was one of the myths to which Mencken did not subscribe. By the standards of his time, he was actually a radical. When you begin by tossing out God and country, as he did exuberantly, there's not much left in the conservative cupboard except family, and he has doubts about that too. In the USA of today, where journalists rank even lower than congressmen in polls of the public's trust and respect, the legend of a man with a typewriter hailed as the civilized consciousness of America sounds like a senile reporter's daydream. The Washington Post and the Boston Globe have been sold for peanuts, for 10 cents on the dollar, compared to their value 20 years ago. And a Pulitzer Prize plus $4.75 will still get you a double latte at Starbucks. Popular websites masquerading as news media now admit that traffic often trumps the truth. If an apocryphal story attracts enough revenue-producing hits, they embrace it without fact checks or apologies. In Mexico and other failed states, people shoot reporters like rats. That Mencken once ruled educated opinion much the way Bismarck ruled Germany, that he was a Pied Piper, trailed by legions of undergraduates and aspiring savants, that he was courted by movie stars and hailed in Europe as the reigning prince of the press. How can we imagine these things in our blasted cultural landscape where celebrity journalism is not recognized as an oxymoron. What bewilders us now, what Mencken achieved that no scribe has approached since or will approach again, was his sheer size. The pie was so much smaller then, and his slice was so huge. To the lowly, marginalized class of news rats who inherited what's left of the Fourth Estate, the reign of Mencken shines in the rearview mirror like some golden age. It's little wonder that writers continue to exhume him, to poke at his remains and marvel at the long shadow he cast across America. Even more remarkable than his impact was his strange doubleness, the veil of contradiction that bars the way to his identity. If his peers judged him eloquent and dangerous, his victims and inferiors judged him subhuman. A survey by biographer Terry Teachout revealed that Mencken was the subject of 500 newspaper editorials in the year 1926 alone. At least 400 were negative. He saved them all in a scrapbook and published the worst of them, of course. A sample, quote, "Mencken with his filthy verbal hemorrhages is so low down in the moral scale, so damnably dirty, so vile and degenerate, that when his time comes to die, it will take a special dispensation from heaven to get him into the bottommost pit of hell." Even I have never... An editorial in the Palm Beach News named Mencken the most universally hated man in the United States. College presidents and archbishops regularly denounced him from the podium. He gloried in such stuff, of course, and in what he saw as the incorrigible stupidity of the yahoos who produced it. But people who knew him well and spent years in his close company also contradict each other when they remember Mencken, so often that his portrait is perpetually blurred. Fred Hobson, one of his most thorough and convincing biographers, titles one of his chapters, "A Loneliness at the Core." Drawing from Mencken's own correspondence and conversations, Hobson makes a case for recurring depression and spells of despair. But his wife's best friend, Sarah Mayfield, an intimate of the Mencken's for decades, writes in her memoir, quote, "No author I've ever known was less a lonely man than Mencken. He was an extrovert, popular both with men and women, always in demand among his numerous friends, constantly entertaining and being entertained." She's speaking of the same man who wrote in his autobiographical notes, quote, "I get little pleasure out of meeting people, and I avoid it as much as possible." George Jean Nathan, his closest professional associate through their years at the Smart Set and the American Mercury, left a marvelous profile of his partner, one built entirely from the bricks of paradox. Quote, "He writes vehemently against quack doctors and has tried 10 of them in an attempt to get rid of hay fever. He insists that he likes only the company of middle-aged women, and he associates solely with young ones. He's an exponent of the Be Hard doctrine, is in favor of killing off the weak, and he sends milk twice a month to the starving babies of war-ridden European countries," and so forth. Apparently, Mencken was such a master of disguise that his biographers have failed even to reach a consensus on the way he dressed. One English journalist wrote that he dressed, quote, "like the owner of a country hardware store, on ceremonial occasions, like a plumber got up for church." Yet one of the contradictions on Nathan's list is this, quote, "he scorns society, but has his evening clothes made by one of the best and most expensive of Fifth Avenue tailors." Dressed to the nines, was Mencken Maurice Chevalier or Jed Clampett? In this case, we should probably trust Nathan, a notorious dandy who knew a nice jacket when he saw one. And perhaps all Americans look like Jed Clampett to the English. As a rule, the private lives and personal eccentricities of writers are a voyeuristic distraction from their work, of little relevance to their literary prestige. If Edmund Wilson was a fat, petulant egoist with a chronic case of satiriasis, He was also a brilliant critic, whose ear for language was a public treasure. But in the case of Mencken, we have to begin by recognizing that he was a major American celebrity, on par in his prime with Babe Ruth and Al Jolson. In one of his playful letters to his North Carolina friend Betty Haynes, he complains that the Hearst newspapers persist in linking him to one Hollywood actress after another. Who was the masked man in the Fifth Avenue tuxedo who looked like a plumber to the Brits? Biographers can't resist the enigma of the private Mencken, in part because his meditations, so copious, shed so little light on his primary motivation, on what he really thought about the work he did so well and so successfully. The nature of literary creation, the clockwork of the literary mind, is a subject he preferred to avoid. The most certain thing we know is that Mencken experienced nausea when writing was dissected in what he considered effeminate, highbrow language. This idiom, ponderously employed by Charles Engoff, his editorial assistant and most hostile biographer, who charged in his book that Mencken was ignorant of, quote, the process of writing, its spiritual and psychological propulsions, its moral overtones, its aesthetic essence, unquote. We can almost hear Mencken expectorating in the general direction of his spittoon. He was a newspaper man, not an assistant professor or a lyric poet. Writing was not a sacrament. He offered his prejudices to America and always insisted that he was indifferent to its response. "I don't give a damn what any American thinks of me," he once told Theodore Dreiser. And it's worth considering whether any other American writer would have said that publicly or privately. "I wrote what I wrote because it was in my nature to do so and for no other reason," he reasserted in the preface to My Life as Author and Editor. "As I've often observed, my fundamental satisfaction was indistinguished from the satisfaction that a hen enjoys in laying an egg." Trying to understand Mencken is a serious commitment, like trying to understand the unified theory. We enter forewarned this vast labyrinth of paradox. Understanding his success is much easier. His inimitably belligerent style and droll pessimism owed nothing to any previous American writer except Mark Twain, to whom he was devoted. Quote, "In all he writes, there's a crackle of blue sparks like those one sees in a dynamo house among revolving masses of metal. Gives you an enormous sense of hidden power," unquote, wrote Joseph Conrad. Mencken at 30, when he began to throw off the sparks that everyone noticed, was an original shining among drab imitations, a tiger released among overweight antelopes. His timing was very fortunate. Thanks to general prosperity, more of the children of the middle class were attending elite institutions and encountering the liberal arts. The stale wisdom of parents and preachers no longer hemmed them in, and Mencken was a guru who illuminated the high road to skepticism and freedom. Any individual with such impregnable confidence in his own opinion, who expresses it with such force, tends to undermine the confidence of anyone whose opinion differs. When I read that Mencken scoffed at Melville and Joyce and belittled Eliot, my natural response was to dismiss him as a tin-eared Philistine. But Mencken would contend, or just sneer, that I had contracted my respect for these classics in a classroom from scholars who had studied them with older scholars in a long conga line of scholars. He would be right, and force me to reconsider what I thought and who taught me to think that way. We are all, including Mencken, the products of a certain set of connections and circumstances. And how much original thinking has gone into our aesthetic responses is always a matter for debate. If we're honest, we're vulnerable, and Mencken's certainty will unsettle and impress us. "He calls you a swine and an imbecile," marveled Walter Lippmann. and he increases your will to live. To use a Coalfields metaphor, extracting literary insights from Mencken's massive oeuvre is more laborious strip mining than mountaintop removal. He left us meager guidance. He told Sarah Mayfield that his style was something he was born with, as natural to him as breathing, though he conceded that he'd nurtured it with prose models such as Thomas Huxley, Jonathan Swift, Friedrich Nietzsche, Ambrose Bierce, and of course Mark Twain. His rare musings on prose style expand on this genetic, organic model with some eloquence. Quote, "For the essence of a sound style is that it cannot be reduced to rules. It is a living and breathing thing with something of the devilish in it. It fits its proprietor tightly and yet ever so loosely, as his skin fits him. It is, in fact, quite as securely an integral part of him as that skin. It hardens as his arteries harden. To attempt to teach style is as silly as to set up courses in making love. The man who makes love out of a book is not making love at all. He is simply imitating someone else making love." Unquote. In sum, the brain is the gun. Mencken's an imposing weapon. Yours, noticeably less so. And every writer should choose for himself how to prime and load it, what to read and learn and practice before he takes the field. What Mencken accomplished as a journalist and critic, what made him unique, seems almost inseparable from his problematic and paradoxical personality. He was a great character, a great scandal, and still arguably a great man. His defiance of church and state was a huge milestone on the long, hard climb toward free speech and respect for the First Amendment in an adolescent nation where the Second Amendment seems to hold more permanent appeal. His style, laced with hyperbole and unadulterated contempt, has profoundly influenced every form of commentary in this country up to this day. There are echoes of him in the hydrophobic Westbrook Pegler, who was almost a caricature of Mencken, in the gonzo Rolling Stone polemics of Hunter Thompson and Matt Taibbi, in the roughshod Lone Star populism of my friend and classmate Molly Ivins, even in the bombast of reactionary cretins like Rush Limbaugh. His voice, filtered through 100 other voices and shades of opinion, may be with us always. I have not steered a course away from it myself. I believed from the outset that the best path for a columnist was to be aggressively unaffiliated and so outspoken that venomous objections would come in from readers stationed left and right. Like Mencken, I felt gratified when the readers obliged me. When the aging Mencken tried to sum himself up, he left us a few fair words to live by. Quote, "The two main ideas that run through all my writing are these. I am strongly in favor of liberty, and I hate fraud." Another sort of last words from Mencken came when he was old, and they asked him why he should be remembered. And he said, "If I've accomplished anything in this world, it is this. I have made life measurably more bearable for the civilized minority in America. The individuals of this minority are often surrounded by dark, dense seas of morons, and so they tend to become helpless. I have reason to believe that my books and other writings have given a little comfort to many such persons and even inspired some of them to revolt." Thank you.
Thank you, Hal. Margaret Gibson is from Richmond and went to St. Catherine's School here and then went from St. Catherine's to what was then Hollins College, from Hollins College then to the University of Virginia, where she received a graduate degree, and then she taught at VCU when she was young up at George Mason when she was young, moved on to Connecticut, got married up there, came back here, taught at VCU, filling in for Dave Smith at some point, and still has friends and neighbors that she stays in touch with. And it's a great pleasure to welcome her here again. I remember when she was a senior, when I was a freshman at Hollins, and she was the very cool, beautiful poet in her class and would read at Graphion readings and was sort of, one was impressed. And since then, I've always followed her poetry with interest from her first book, Signs, I think was the name of it, up through the Daybooks of Tina Madotti, which won the Melville Kane Award, Vigil, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, her memoir about growing up in Richmond, her poems about things as varied as her dog, again, a dog, and the different paintings of Chinese and Japanese art. And this particular book, I think, is a hard one and heartfelt one for her. And since many of us have known David, we welcome the chance to remember him with her this evening. And I hope you all will buy and read The Broken Cup and welcome Margaret.
Thank you, Mary. I was really afraid Mary was going to say that when I was at Hollins, the thing she remembered when she was a freshman and I was a senior was that she really liked the fact that my hair was always in place. You said that once. Things change. Well, the voice of these poems will be as different from Mencken as I can imagine. Thank you, Hal, for that really wonderful, vivid, and trenchant introduction to him. Makes me want to go back and read him. My husband, David McCain, whom some of you had in class here at VCU in, when was it, 1988, 1989, I think, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2007. And life changed for both of us dramatically. And I will not speak a lot about that in a kind of prose way from up here, but I will just say that if anyone wants to talk about caregiving or Alzheimer's or anything like that afterwards or at Mary's, I'm very happy to tell you what I know. But the poems also tell you a lot about what I know. And I just said that our lives changed very dramatically, and human beings are funny creatures. We don't like change very much, except when we're intensely happy, and then we want everything to stay the same. When we're unhappy, of course, we can't wait for change to come in. This poem that I'm going to start with begins with that dread of change, in a sense, pushing it to the side, wanting it not to, even to an extent denying it. The poem is called Heaven. The leaves are turning one by one, carried away in the crisp wind. In one letter he penned, Coleridge turned away, calling love a local anguish he meant to leave behind him. Away, away, says the blue and gold day, and no one hears it but the wind, whose law it echoes. The dog has a red ball to chase. You pick a flat, perfect stone for the wall you hope to live long enough to rebuild. I prune briars, pick burrs from the dog's fur. I teach come and sit, sit here, a longer sit beneath the cedars. The grass is freshly cut, sun low, all the energy of a summer's day rushing into bulb and root. The dog runs off, returns. The stones balance steeply. Good work, good dog. This is heaven. Sit, stay. Alzheimer's is all about loss, and most people think of it as simply a loss of language, but it's a loss of a lot of things. And there's also a restlessness that, in this poem, has an aesthetic side to it, but it's all about change, too. It's a poem called Revising. This man who loves things, he's moving things from here to there in the house, but not randomly. No, no. He moves things to their rightful places, and he has a motive and a cue for action. For example, two paintings shifted from separate rooms where they've hung for years now share a common wall in the library where the setting sun strikes their gold leaf frames. Corn shocks in a field, a loaded hay wagon, a farmer with his pitchfork now hung below an Anglican formal silk knotted and embroidered rendering of an open coffin. The bare body, absent perspective, about to spill out of the box, but it doesn't, held in place, no doubt, by the upright bishops. Behold the man, they seem to say, behold the corn god who died for our sins. They're both about harvest, David insists. But can't we just let things be, I cry, because too much is changing, too much is forgotten, misplaced, because I want each thing to stay where I left it, where I want it, where I know it, keeping vigil over our rife impermanence, because these things will live longer than we will, because he will forget their names and ours, because he will die and I will. Just tell me why you keep moving things. The words hardly out of my mouth, and I get it. The house is his poem. The poem is his life. He's revising, as I will this poem, hitching one sound to the next sound, shifting this image nearer that one, coupling. Just this moment in the dusty cupboard, he has juxtaposed the flawless Mesoamerican bowl and the Japanese bird whose beak I banged off by accident. His mother's teapot, restored, next to a bowl he bought right off the potluck table because he wanted the image of the Fisher King swinging his ankles, whistling in the quiet of his heart. Isn't it all about the heart? About accident, appetite, repair, and original paint? About rupture and relishing, wounded flesh, and the joy of returning home moment by moment, trying to know this place, and the two of us who live here, seeing into our true nature as if for the first time. Now, I'm going to get to some poems that have to do with the sort of more practical nitty-gritty of life in the great forgetting and the long goodbye, but the book begins with a poem called Sentences. And the book is not called The Broken Cup, but Broken Cup. And I want the poem to be, the first poem is Sentences, because it's somewhat, it's got a philosophical bent to it. And I think it's important. I think that I have learned as much about who we are from being with David, going through his forgetting and all of his losses of what we often think we are and prize most about ourselves. The disease has brought a lot to my attention. The poem is called Sentences. It's an essay. It's addressed to David. It's in parts, and I'm just going to be pausing between parts and also sometimes between sections in a longer part. Sentences. I have a friend who thinks it's terrible there are no answers. He doesn't believe in God because God would be an answer. One could know, and we don't know. I say he believes without knowing he believes. He scoffs at that, and I think to myself, the root of believe is to hold dear, therefore to live with caring. I admit I'm stretching the root, but my friend lives as if he's taken Pascal's wager. He paints stroke by stroke. He wagers. He creates a world. Theoretical physicists believe there are six flavors of quarks. Their names are up, down, strange, charm, bottom, and top. They believe this. They eat breakfast. They go for walks inside the landscape of an electron. But you, my beloved, who forget that you forget, and who make beautiful sense of this world, would dismiss such cogitations. You would focus on the sheer joy of one breath. This one breath. If I identify with what stays, I am one thing. If with what flows, another. I am a river in disguise. A river knows that place and once are not fathomed, plumbed, or tallied. When I stand at the edge of Main Brook and watch the snow melt sweeping around the prow of stone upright in the cascading torrents, I am of one mind. When I straighten up, having lifted and lightly balanced mossy stones to make a cairn, I am of one mind. When I bow before the tree whose roots slide over a shoulder of granite jutting out of the earth, whose roots hold the stone steady, flowing past it and embracing the stone, disappearing into the dark source that makes all words one, I am of no mind. Is it so terrible not to have answers? I grant you it's terrible to lose one's mind. As burst of light by burst of light, the neurons misfire, unable to reach across synapses, making run-on sentences, eroded fragments, tangles. In the metaphor of eclipse, the mind is shadowed. No ricochet of radiant protons graces its surface. Where did you grow up? You ask me. My story, you knew it once. Yours too. Now you read your memoir more moved than when you wrote it. The story's fresh, immediate, your depth of feeling no longer held in check by intellect. You read the sentences, your lifelines, amazed. Is it in your DNA, perhaps? A coded sentence. You will, like your mother before you, be asked to let go of all you hold dear. Our friend picks up his paintbrush, you put down your pen. Think of Sisyphus, condemned to accomplish nothing, sentenced to toil uphill to that resting place where the stone crests and settles, tilts and tumbles down. What is his mind at that moment? I keep wanting you to tell me what you remember, what you know and do not know as the stone rolls, as the river flows, as the root sinks deeper, as is its way out of sight. Eclipsed, the moon goes dark, but the moon is still there, a deep presence held in place, disguised as an eddy in the river. These metaphors, I believe. Up, down, strange, charm, bottom, and top, hums the chorus in the background as Oedipus, that beautiful man, snow-haired at Colonus, says openly, all is well. And you, who were memory's scribe, this is now what you say. I have been lucky. I have been lucky all my life. I'm going to read a series of poems without saying much between them now that have to do with sort of the nitty-gritty of being at home with this. This poem is called Tasks, and it has an epigraph, something that a Sufi teacher said. The task of a human being is to transform suffering into joy. Tasks. And along the way, there's housework. Forget the computer, the checkbook, the inscrutable repair of whatever overheats or squeaks or ices over. Never mind the wooden lamppost, rotten, fallen on its face like a corpse in the wet grass, which needs to be cut. Your allotted jobs are to dust, fold the laundry, tasks in which you take such unsung pleasure, I'm abashed. I'm sorting cutlery. I'm Job in a bathrobe, wondering where, oh, where in the wrong drawer you put it. We'll make a good wife of you yet, I nearly joke. But look at you, so happy, I bite my tongue. Enactment. Do you ever catch yourself thinking something, or a little thought that kind of goes by real quietly in your mind, and you wish later you'd paid more attention to it because you're acting out something that you could have caught earlier if you had? Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what this is. Enactment. A bit of climbing vine, copied in silver and cleverly linked, that was the tie that bound me, the cord about my wrist, the shackle. I couldn't work the catch, nor explain to you how to do it, although I tried. You went for pliers, the wrong tool. All the while, my voice a rising crescendo, my eyes wild, complaint and imprecation, and deep within me an image of the Gats, the self-immolation of pious widows, and I've been good. I don't deserve this. Why? And you, standing by, wanting to help, you could only blame yourself. Incompetent. That's when I calmed down, and the bracelet snapped open and fell into the sink, into the abyss of yesterday's whisper, far back in the mind, barely audible. Trapped. Losing it. What little I know, I hold more dear now that I take the daily reinvention of loss as my teacher. I'll never graduate from this college, whose MA translates Master of Absence, with a subtext in the imperative, misplace anything. If there's anything I want, it's that more people I love join the search party. You are the one renowned among friends for your luck in retrieving from the wayside the perfect bowl for the kitchen, a hand-carved deer, a pencil-drawn portrait of a young girl whose brimming innocence still makes me ache. Now the daily litany of losses goes like this. Do you have your wallet, keys, glasses, gloves, giraffe? Oh dear, I forgot my giraffe. That's the preferred response, but no, it's usually the glasses, the gloves, the wallet, the keys I've hidden. And when I get frantic, when I've lost my composure, my nerve, my compassion, I have only what little I know to save me. Here's what I know. It's not absence I fear, but anonymity. I remember taking a deep breath, stopped in my tracks. I'd been looking for an important document I had myself misplaced, high and low, no luck yet. I was beside myself, so there may indeed have been my double running the search party. Stop, you said gently. I'll go get Margaret. She'll know where it is. But I'm Margaret, I gasped. No. You held out before me a copy of one of my books, pointing to the author's photograph. You know her, you said. We looked into each other's eyes a long time. The earth tilted on its axis, and what we were looking for, each other and ourselves, took the tilt, and we slid into each other's arms, holding on for dear life, holding on. People say the darndest things sometimes, and a friend of my daughter's said to me, I'm like, hi, Margaret, and then, are you prepared for the day he won't know your name? Well, it's pretty early on. She meant it compassionately. This poem called Rosemary, naming things and getting the right names on things is something that begins to that goes. And in the beginning of the poem, I'm doing a little poet thing, trying to reinvent names for spring. But it's all about forgetting, really. Rosemary. Bud Pierce, Sun Talon, Blood Briar, spring insists on renaming itself. Are you prepared for the day he won't know your name? And I might have answered, Lord of milk and suck, Lord of straddle these thighs, what is my name compared to the 10,000 unspoken, solemn, or spangled names of God? And I might have answered, I've forgotten how to prepare. I've forgotten how to pray. But I am learning now to retrieve stray wordlings that shake loose from his sentences. Chalice and shovel, hold me, buried root. And to say them as a rosary is said, or a mantram. And perhaps I can also pray with the cutting of rosemary I scissored from a clay pot on a sill of the sun. Smell this, I say, stroking his shoulders and his neck with an arabesque of its green fragrance. Smell this. Who cares what we call it? In the acknowledgments, there's a list of wonderful friends who were so present and came and did, were just so helpful. So don't get me wrong, but there are other people who say the darndest things. This is a poem that was in Blackbird called Like Ice. What is it about some people? As I'm leaving his house after a convivial visit, my host, an old friend, stares at his shoes and mutters, I can't see much good ahead. Is he Cassandra or yesterday's news? Does he mean to be saying he'll help out or opt out? There's always good, I reply, meaning the sooner the better. However one defines or would embody the sublime, it would be better if it arrived pronto. Before David, intent on a mission he's forgotten, wanders off into the woods, before he shivers to see daylight wane and an undefined darkness slur along the window glass, before I'm so glad means I just do as I'm told. You think you have it bad, another friend quipped too quickly, then pulled herself up short, and you do. I don't recall what she said next. With practice, one can simply watch as an agony, like ice in warm liquid, dissolves without altering the level in the glass. I'm going to read the title poem now, and after that, a couple more. One of the big things that I've learned during the last few years is I'm going to talk about broken cup right now as a metaphor, but it was a literal cup. But there was always in David's and my loving each other a certain degree of idealization, which would get us in trouble. One of the gifts of this disease is learning to let everything be as it is and to love one's brokenness, the other person's brokenness, and one's own. So that's what this poem is about. At a certain point, the heart has to break open. And when that happens, it's a good thing. Broken cup. I've forgotten how it broke, the great cause or the petty cause that cracked the handle into two pieces and left me without a cup for morning coffee. In the cabinet, there were others of white porcelain with steeply elegant lines, cups that matched their saucers. But my cup was Mexican, squat, and as round as Rivera's peasant bent before the wall of callas he carried on his back, his burden of blossoms. Hand-painted, my cup was carnival purple and yellow, flowers that honored earth, birth, death, geometry, symmetry, riot, good sex, good coffee, the sun rising hot. I banished it, broken, to my desk and used it for paperclips. Now I've rescued it, fit and glued the pieces back together. Still, I'm afraid to lift it, even to wash it by hand in hot water. It is that fragile. You brought me the cup from Puerto Vallarta, that seaside trip you took to help your daughter past heartbreak. A little hotel by the sea with bougainvillea and a great deal on cocktails as the sun rolled its dying splendor onto the Pacific. I think I was jealous. I was jealous. I hope you drank margaritas and missed me. Most likely Dos Equis with a squirt of lime. The cup gave me Mexico each morning on the cheap. I loved it. I loved it. It broke. I ignored it. I cast it aside. Sounds like a classic sitcom bad marriage. Sounds like the wary caregiver who reads the 36-hour day heart empty. Who really wants to know about this despair? I have minimizing friends who tell me it's not so bad, just a little accelerated forgetting, such as we all have these days. Oh, Ancient of Days, that was once a name for God, for something so deep within the self it's beyond us. Even so, it is possible I want to tell them to love what is broken, possible, urgent, and necessary. And so for love of thee and me, I take my broken cup and set it down before me on a yellow placemat. I make toast with ginger jam and real butter, coffee whose beans have flourished on a mountain in Peru, I hope near Machu Picchu. I sit down in my Japanese bathrobe, in my Navajo beads with bare feet. I sit without ire or envy, without fear or despair, and eat and drink slowly, very slowly, savoring all I can remember of that first night we met, the good talk, the dancing until we were too tired to do anything else but take the dancing to bed, the miracle of unintended meeting, the first of what was to be years of meeting, moments I hope to remember when I lie down to die, my beautiful love, your head of unruly hair and unruly thoughts unraveling into a silence that will lengthen or may break off, as this handle did, into pieces. Who knows how love will hold, or if we will ever be all right? Who knows what wrong tastes like, or how much emptiness the cup will hold as we share it? Who knows? And if it is the cup of suffering, drink it down. Or better, may it pass from you, and you live easy and go gently where you will or where you must. I'll go with you. Grateful for plum-colored flowers so close to bruising, coffee, sunlight, earth, the journeys we took together and the long one left us to walk until we lie down near clear water, shade trees, and green pasture. In that place there will be nothing unspoken, nothing forgotten or feared. Day or night, whatever the hour, it will be all shining. Our whole and broken bodies full of light. I don't think this poem needs much explanation. It's called Bed. There are pauses in it again. Bed. Well, we're not 16 anymore, I say softly. Funny you should say that, and you began talking memory, as if we were in fact 16, mistaking me for some distant virginal mist rising off female flesh like fog off a lake. I didn't know you then, I reply. I'm your wife now, remember? Happy also to be your mistress, if you like. We're laughing now, under the covers, your face near my thighs. You come up for air, a conspirator. Margaret likes that too. Making love takes longer. We make reservations as if for dinner out. Afternoons for delight, bed or sofa. Well, isn't the body a space-time event? Isn't it a river or the color of the ridge seen through winter woods at four when sun spills gold on it, then russet and purple, dun and dusk? Your skin, you murmur, soft, here, feel, so beautiful, it's so beautiful. Here and now, snow falling outside, and we're warm inside each other. Have we ever done this before? It's okay, you can laugh. I did. Goodness gracious. It's a poem called Happiness, which was also in Blackbird. David loves the Dalai Lama and has read all of his books, and even now in his room has a picture of me and a picture of the kids and a picture of the Dalai Lama, whom he refers to as the big guy. Well, he doesn't refer to him anymore, but he used to refer to him as the big guy. Happiness. An art, not a right. Happiness, according to the Dalai Lama, David reads aloud to me, is not elused, as one might think, but closer and crisp. I wonder if his screwing up how words are said is prologue to a deeper detour in the neuronal relays, or is it faulty eyesight as he speeds over the lines of small print? Now he looks out the window at a steady drizzle. He smiles and calls it the seep and slur of rain. He enjoys punching out the stressed syllables as he returns to reading, a measure of personal happiness. Happiness, our purpose in life, not selfish, as one might suppose, although the wish to avoid unhappiness may be. And I remember a friend's sad report. He put his urine-soaked underpants on my face one night as I slept. She told me this serenely, as if the experience she'd had with her husband's dementia would be mine. There was no stopping it. I said nothing, only fixed my mind on the remembered smell of David's skin. Something like saffron married to a whiff of ripe pears and worn-out cotton undershirts. Blindfolded, I could distinguish David and find him in a crowd of men, were I allowed to snuffle each man's neck and smell the difference. And that thought gave me happiness. As unexpected as was the glimpse of the road that moved beneath us as we sped home on a morning long ago, after a night of reading each other's poems aloud, every blessed one of them, the road beneath us seen through the rotting out porous floor of the old Jeep, we traveled at the speed of light and nothing could slow us down or keep us separate from each other or the road, wherever it took us. And I'm going to try this. This is a poem I haven't read before out loud to people. It's a little speculative. It's the last poem in the book. It's called A Good Death. One thing you might like to know is that David adored William Blake as a writer, as a thinker, as a revolutionary, as a free spirit. So this would be A Good Death. A Good Death. May you die as did that good man, William Blake, who shortly before broke into singing. Before that, called his wife an angel and drew not just her face, but her whole and spiritual body. Closer to it, he said he would be forever near to care for her. After that, and after the singing, he was still. Of course, when your good death comes, you'll have most likely lost the power of utterance. Not a word left to summon, not a scrap of whistled melody. No, you will have been for a time in deepest soliloquy, in an immense silence, immersed in whatever in us is powerful, ancient, free. But since the truth of the imagination for most of us needs to be embodied, may you also, while now there's time, practice dying before you die. May you daily stand outside time's rush, whose rivering is our natural light, and there on the steep lip of what we call darkness. Call me angel, if angel I am. Draw sunbursts in the rainlit air. Sing your heart out. Great being, radiantly still and near. Thank you very much.